Now, Philip French introduces this week's replay.
The name of A.J. Allen is now almost entirely forgotten, but in the first decades of British broadcasting, he was a revered figure. He made his first appearance on the air in 1924 at Savoy Hill, when the call sign 2LO was at least as famous, possibly more so, than the initials BBC. A.J. Allen was a pseudonym for Leslie Harrison Lambert, a full-time civil servant with a private income, and his reputation was enhanced by the fact that his photograph never appeared in Radio Times, that biographical details were denied to inquirers, and that he restricted his broadcast to 2 or 3 a year. Allen's art was the short story, and he was the first short story writer to make his reputation solely through radio. His contemporary equivalent might be the rather more conspicuous and certainly more prolific Garrison Keillor. My parents and their friends would be sure to stay home whenever Allen made those rare, cherished appearances. And like most listeners, they believed he was one of those so-called natural storytellers who could just sit there and spin a yarn off the cuff. This, as you will shortly hear, was not the case, any more than it was with Chekhov or Somerset Maugham. Not that I am comparing him with those great masters, though he was in his day a real spellbinder, a lapel-grabbing raconteur who had a whole nation hanging on his words. The subgenre in which he specialised was, I suppose, the comic Shaggy Dog story, a very British form, though by no means unique to these islands. And his manner we might now regard as affected, a trifle precious, parodic, camp in fact, the style of quite a few of the leading broadcasters and comedians of his day. It may well be that the camp manner allowed many middle-class writers and speakers in those days to establish an intimate relationship with a popular audience, denied to the more reserved, clipped, stiff upper lip speakers of the same class. I'm thinking of the immense success as newspaper columnists and broadcasters of Beverly Nichols and Godfrey Wynne, and conjecturing about the relationship in the interwar years between middle-class homosexuals and their working-class lovers. Before you hear one of his tales, I'd like to play you a short memoir of A.J. Allen by Stuart Hibbert, first broadcast in 1948. In his day, Hibbert was even better known than Allen. His was the most familiar voice in Britain, and he was a crucial arbiter of broadcasting style. He joined the BBC in 1923 on the presentation staff, and was for many years the corporation's chief announcer. In 1938, in a series of 50 WD&HO Wills cigarette cards devoted to radio personalities, Hibbert was number one. So, Stuart Hibbert on A.J. Allen.
A.J. Allen was the mystery man of radio. Tell me, who is this fellow Allen? What's he look like? Is Allen his real name? How many times had I been asked such questions? I always remember A.J.'s entrance to the studio, the slim, neat figure in the perfectly cut dinner jacket, the eyeglass, the thin black briefcase, the cheerful smile which seemed to say, I'm feeling on top of the world and I hope you are too. Who discovered him? How did he come to begin? One night, Sir William Bull, a director of the old British Broadcasting Company, happened to tell a short story from 2LO. A.J. heard it at home, and next day called on Rex Palmer, then director of the London station, and told him he had heard it, said he had ideas for several short stories, and asked for an audition. Rex was so struck by his personality and performance that he engaged him at once, and in his very first broadcast, a story called My Adventure in Jermyn Street, made such a hit that whenever his name appeared in the Radio Times, thousands of listeners made a note of the date and time in their diaries. When broadcasting, he used to sit on a high stool close up to the microphone, originally the old meat-safe magnetophone type, with his manuscript pasted on sheets of cardboard in a pile on his knees. He spoke very quietly at the microphone, and if you fidgeted or creaked your chair, you got a black look. He took himself most seriously when broadcasting, and never smoked or drank for at least a week beforehand. But he obviously enjoyed it, and knew that he was giving pleasure to countless others. Being a government servant, his name was not Allen, he did not have to do it for a living, and was careful to nurse the demand he created by appearing in the programs only 2 or 3 times a year. The idea of the sheets of cardboard was to eliminate any possibility of paper rustle, which would have destroyed at once the illusion he was out to create, namely, that he was sitting by his own fireside, relating some incredible adventure that had just happened to him. Once, in the late 1920s, he read in the paper that the lights had gone out while I was reading the news, and how I managed to carry on with the aid of matches and a candle until the bulletin ended. So the next time he came to the studio, he insisted on having the candle lit in the reading lamp beforehand, just in case, as Claude Dampier would say. The electric light did not go out, but the candle did, suddenly with a loud click, for there was only a stump of it, and the spring in the reading lamp jerked it out, throwing the grease all over him. But A.J., unperturbed, carried on as if nothing had happened. After that experience, he decided never to trust BBC candles again, and always brought his own candle in a candlestick and solemnly lit it before he began. "No," he said, "I'm taking no chances." What was the secret of his art? For art it certainly was. First, he was a born raconteur, with ideas, imagination, and a keen sense of humor, who, being a first-class radio technician, saw in a flash the great possibilities of radio as a medium for his own particular line. Then, he also thoroughly understood the intimate nature of the microphone, and made each one of you think that he was telling the story to you and to you alone. It was all done in such a natural, detached, and effortless way. But you mustn't run away with the idea that his stories were just reeled off without effort or thought beforehand. Oh, dear, no. He took the very greatest care in the preparation and rehearsal of the manuscripts. And having written and timed a story, he was most meticulous about timing, he would record it, play it back to himself, noting where to put in the little asides, which always seemed to be so spontaneous. Then he would ask one or two trusted friends to come to his house to listen and to criticize, adding a pause here, altering a downward inflection of the voice there, until he himself was reasonably satisfied with the result. Yes, the result was certainly a work of originality. He was one of the first to explore the uncharted continents of broadcasting. But more than that, it was, in fact, the inimitable A.J. Allen.
That was Stuart Hibbert on A.J. Allen, broadcast in 1948. And now we go back a decade earlier to hear one of the inimitable A.J. Allen's stories. It's called The Fire Bell, and it was recorded off transmission when he delivered it live in May 1937.
Good evening, everyone. Last year, an extremely unpleasant thing happened to me. I was fetched back to London during my summer leave to attend a conference. It was a rotten conference anyhow, all about nothing, and it didn't even stand us lunch, but it went on until it was too late to start back to the country. And there was another man in the same boat as me, a fellow called Mason. He's at the Home Office, and he'd had to come all the way back from Cornwall, so we arranged to put up at the Durham, near Hyde Park, and we thought we'd do a show of some sort during the evening. Anyway, we sat down to dinner in the hotel restaurant about 7:30, and we hadn't then made up our minds what to go and see. We were just sort of talking about nothing much when I began to be rather curious about the accent of some people sitting at the table behind me. It's always rather fun trying to guess what part of the world people come from by the way they speak, and I couldn't place this couple at all. They were English all right and well-educated, but there was something about their intonation which was new to me. However, after a bit, they started mentioning Hobart, which, as you all know, is the capital of Tasmania. And I thought, oh, that's it. I could see them in a mirror, and they were obviously a middle-aged husband and wife, and their table was laid for three. Presently, in came a girl of about 18, who was evidently their daughter. And my word, everyone turned to look at her. She was quite lovely, tall, with wonderful red hair, rather the film star type, admittedly, but, lips and eyebrows horrible and inflamed fingernails and all the rest of it, but even so, she was very, very striking. And, as I say, she made a sensation. But I'm afraid she wasn't quite as nice as she looked. It wasn't long before she'd started a real row with her family. And one couldn't help hearing what it was all about, because she had one of those regrettable voices which you sometimes come across. What had apparently happened was that Father had made a mistake and taken tickets for the wrong play. She'd thought they were going to a thing called Toodaloo, whereas he'd got seats for the Old Vic, Shakespeare or something, and not exactly in her line. And she went on about it, getting shriller and shriller, until finally poor old Pop tottered out to the telephone to see if he could do anything about changing the seats. Well, that caused a lull for a bit, but he came back looking thoroughly miserable and said he hadn't been able to do anything at all, and it was going to be Shakespeare or nothing. Whereupon, her ladyship started all over again, only 10 times worse, and it got quite embarrassing. I mean, it was early, and not many people there, and, well, it is awkward when things like that happen. However, the situation was saved, because a fella got up from a table somewhere the other side of them, and he came up and said to the father, "Excuse me for butting in and all that, but we haven't been able to help hearing that your daughter is a shade disappointed at not being able to go to Toodaloo tonight. And it so happens that my wife and I are going. And we have a spare stall. So if your daughter, if you'll allow your daughter to come with us, we shall be more than delighted. And we'll bring her back the moment the performance is over." Well, of course, the old people didn't like to accept all at once, but they finally agreed, and the man went back to his table, and the rest of the room heaved a sigh of relief, and we went on with our dinner in peace. I said to Mason, I wonder what the chances are against a thing like that happening. Here's a girl who wants to go to a theatre. There's only one seat left in the world, and someone 3 yards off has got it in his pocket. And Mason said, yes, but has he got it in his pocket? And I said, I see what you mean, but surely those people are much too solid and dull to be in that line of business. And he said, don't you believe it, that's how it's done. Anyway, I'm going out to make some arrangements, and don't turn round because they haven't seen you. And off he went. He was back in a few minutes, and he said, this looks like being a really good show. What always happens is that we don't hear about these things until the day after, and the girl's gone for good, and it's too late. And there have been 3 very like this since Christmas. So to see one start under one's very nose is an absolute gift. And I said, I see your point. What's the next move? And he said, we're going to follow them wherever they go. So we finished dinner and went out, and I got the car round, and we sat in her about 30 yards short of the hotel entrance. I couldn't help laughing. On the other side of the road, there were 2 obvious police cars drawn up, back to back, ready to start off either way. And through the railings, just inside the park, I saw a very suspicious-looking motorcycle combination. The men weren't in uniform, but there wasn't much doubt about them. When I said to Mason, I said, you've certainly done the thing in style, but haven't you any aeroplanes kicking about? And I forget what he said to that, and just then our party appeared at the door of the hotel and got into a car. I think it was a hired car, because the chauffeur didn't seem to know him by sight. That is to say, he didn't get out to open the door until the man went across the pavement and spoke to him. Anyhow, off they started with us after them. Well, I said, they won't go to the theatre anyway. Mason said, oh, yes, they will, or the girls smell a rat. She knows where she's going, but when they get there, they'll pretend there's something wrong about their seats, which, of course, they haven't got, and then they'll take her somewhere else, and she won't know where she's going. Well, they did go to the theatre, but unfortunately, we weren't able to see what happened at the box office, because I was caught by the traffic lights. Mason did his best and got there as soon as he could, but he was too late. And I had to keep in the stream going past the theatre, and he came out and told me to park the car somewhere handy and come back, which I did. And he then told me that somehow or other they'd managed to get tickets and go in. And he said, what's more, we're going in too, as a grateful government has stood us a box. And I thought, splendid. I mean, it was much better than hanging about outside. So we waited till the curtain had gone up and then went in. And there were our three, bang in the middle of the front row of the stalls. We had to keep well back, of course, in case any of them looked up, but they didn't. They were too busy watching the play. They bought her an enormous box of chocolates, but I must say she wasn't behaving frightfully well. She laughed a little too loudly and rather threw herself about in her seat. I'm not suggesting for a moment that she'd had too much to drink. I mean, perish the thought, but she was in a very excited state. Well, nothing interesting happened during the show, except that one of Mason's myrmidons came in and took a photograph. And just before the end, we went and collected the car and waited in a side street. It was a street you could see the theatre from if you stood at the corner. It sounds a bit involved, that, but I hope you'll follow me. And there was no risk of our losing their car because it had to pass us before it could turn off anywhere. And this had all been arranged for us while we were inside. Well, presently the audience began to come out, and in due course, our lot. We were too far off to see much that happened, but it looked as though they were having an altercation of some sort on the pavement. And while they were arguing, their car was blocking the way with everyone behind hooting at them. And they pushed off at last, and we followed. And it was soon quite clear that they were not going back to the hotel. We went along Tottenham Court Road, Euston Road, Finchley Road, and out towards Barnet, and it was most thrilling. Up till then, I don't mind confessing that I'd been a bit doubtful whether we might have been a bit too clever, but this run out of London settled it. We had great fun going along. You may remember we'd started off with two police cars and a motor bicycle, a sidecar thing. But by the time we'd passed Hendon, we'd collected several more, and even that didn't end it. Instructions had been sent on ahead, and that we were to be looked out for, so we kept on overtaking other police cars, which also joined the procession, and until we must have looked like a blooming motor rally. I tell you, there was never a dull moment. Of course, the police cars had all got wireless, and the motor bicycle gentleman kept coming up alongside us and handing in messages from Scotland Yard about ports being watched and so on. In fact, everything was fairly on the buzz. However, we finally stopped at a roadhouse. Police, the car in front did. I had to go past and turn round, and what happened to our retinue, I don't know. They seemed to melt away, but they can't have gone far. Anyway, we came back and shoved the car in the parking place at the side of this precious caravanserai. And after a bit, I went inside to see what was going on. It was a large place, and it didn't look as though it had been open long. The decorations looked too clean. There was an orchestra of sorts making a nasty noise, and a few people dancing in the middle of the room. And the rest of the space was chock-full of small tables with a rather mixed lot having drinks. Our three were at a table on the edge of where the dancing was going on. And I was looking round for somewhere quiet to sit when I saw a bar at the side of the room. It was just the thing. It had got Moorish arches and fretwork in front of it, so I got behind that and watched through the interstices. I tried to get a drink, but there was nothing but lemon squash if the man didn't know you, and it might have been rather dull if it hadn't been for our red-haired young woman. She'd somehow managed to get hold of some champagne, and it wasn't making her any quieter. She kept calling out remarks to the people dancing and so on, and her host and hostess began to look thoroughly disgusted. And finally, the man got up and came across to the bar. He asked for a whiskey and soda, and couldn't have it, of course, and that was the last straw. He turned to me, and he said, if only I could get hold of the fellow who rang that fire bell. I said, what fire bell? And he said, would you really like to know? Because if I don't tell someone about it quite soon, I shall burst. And I said, yes, I really should like to know, and I should hate you to burst. So he told me, and he said, I've got a son in the Navy. He's a sub-lieutenant, and he's taking a course at the navigation school Portsmouth. And I don't know whether you know the navigation school, but it's actually inside the dockyard. And I said, yes, I do know that. He said, very well, then. About a week ago, some young idiot taking the course got out at 2 o'clock in the morning and rang the dockyard fire bell for fun. Well, there was a frightful row, naturally, and Commander-in-Chief Portsmouth was so angry about it that he's stopped all their leave until the culprit owns up. And no one has owned up, except four people who couldn't have done it, and all leave is still stopped. Well, I said disgraceful, but rather wondering what he was driving at. However, he explained. He said, today's my son's birthday. My wife and I are staying in London, and he was coming up for the night, and we were all going to the theatre, a thing called Toodaluka, but of course he couldn't come. Well, during dinner at our hotel, a young woman at the next table started making a fuss because her father'd taken seats for the wrong play. She wanted to see this Toodaluka, and he'd booked for something quite different, and she made such a scene about it that we simply had to suggest her coming with us, as we'd got a spare seat. And she did, and she's been simply appalling. She was bad enough in the theatre, but when it was over, she flatly refused to go home. She insisted on being brought to this disreputable place. And he said, you know, it's all very well, but I'm the town clerk of, well, it wasn't Birmingham, but somewhere jolly like it. And he said, you know, if our watch committee ever got to hear that I'd been seen in such a haunt of vice, they'd probably make me resign. By the way, things were rapidly becoming much worse. An extremely vulgar cabaret turn had taken the floor, and our young friend was standing on a table conducting it with a fork. Well, I said, the best thing for you to do is to take her home. He said, take her home. He said, that's just it. She won't go home. I said, oh, we can soon arrange that. I know some people here. And I beckoned up Mason. He was standing at the back, and introduced them. And I said, that obstreperous young woman has become too much for our friend here, and he wants us to cart her home. But he said, the town clerk, that is, said, oh, no, I'm afraid I can't do that. You see, I don't know you, gentlemen, and I promised her father and mother I'd be responsible for her. Mason and I grinned a bit, if you can help it, but he said, if you'll help me get her into our car, we shall be very much obliged. So we said, just as you like, and we waited our chance and just hustled her out, and before you could say knife, we were all on our way back to London. And when we got to the Durham, old Stick in the Mud, I mean the town clerk said, rather surprised, he said, are you two staying here? And I said, yes. And he said, what an extraordinary coincidence. And I said, yes, isn't it? Good night, everyone.